fog is lifting. She's in a rowboat on a lake. She is dreaming. She is drifting. Never been so wide awake. Captured in the moment by the beauty all around her. There's nowhere else that she would rather be. And Virginia looks up. She says, this could be my day. And she thinks a thought of thanks for all the things that come her way. And some say she's a dreamer, and some call her a fool. But before you even blink your eyes, Virginia saves her money, grabs her backpack, hops a jet plane, heads to France, grows a garden, writes a screenplay, and she's learning how to dance. And all the possibilities of her imagination are turning into her reality. And Virginia looks up, she says, this could be my day.
Hello. This is Karen Motokaitis, and you're listening to How She Really Does It, where inspiration and possibility meet. I believe there are many ways to live life. I believe there are many journeys for us to take. I believe we can learn from others to see what is possible for ourselves. There are possibilities for all of us, not just the ones who've acquired great success, but including those of us who have stumbled, lost our way, or only saw closed doors. With this show, maybe you can now see a glimmer coming through the windows. I call that the window of possibilities. Each week, I bring a guest who represents those possibilities. Some have gone through their own struggles, and others are experts in their field. My guests are an example of what is possible when you continue, when you learn, leap, fall down, and get back up. I invite you into this space so you can ask yourself, if that is possible, what is possible for me? Really, ask yourself that. Join me each week for inspiration, empowerment, and entertainment. You can connect with me on my website at www.howshereallydoesit.com and sign up for my weekly newsletter. There are also Twitter and Facebook links, as well as send me an email. I'd love to hear from my listeners. Each live show is recorded and available on my website as a podcast or also available from iTunes for free. Elise Resch is an MSRD, and she is the co-author of Intuitive Eating. And her philosophy embraces the goal of reconnecting with the internal wisdom with our body about eating with which one is born for the purpose of developing a healthy and satisfying relationship with food and our body. And today, Elise is here to discuss intuitive eating in children. Elise, welcome back.
Oh, thank you. I'm so happy to be back.
It's great to have you back. And so you have the third edition of Intuitive Eating coming out.
Yes.
And you've included a chapter on children and food. Before we go to that, can you just give the listener some background of what really is intuitive eating? What does that mean?
I believe we're all born with the internal wisdom that we need to have to know how to eat. If you're watching a baby, you know, any of you have been around babies, you see that when they're hungry, they cry. And when they're full, they stop eating. If you try to feed a baby beyond fullness, she will just turn her little head and not take it. So I think that we have this wisdom early on. I think that when there's a strong attunement between the parent and the child, where the child starts to get feedback that his signals are correct, his hunger signals, his fullness signals are correct because the parent is very tuned in to that, that child starts to trust. And as he grows up, if there is a respect for the child's internal signals, hunger, fullness, taste preference, then that child is able to keep all of that wisdom intact. But unfortunately, many children get diverted from that. And so the basis of intuitive eating, though, is really looking at child studies and toddler studies and psychological issues that are connected with power struggles and autonomy and deprivation.
And with intuitive eating, so it's, you know, reading your chapter and going through and understanding your book, we are born with these skills inside of us, but somehow along the way it changes. And is that from the way our parents treated food with us?
Well, I think that's one piece of it. I also think that there are often messages today. We have this, you know, fear of this obesity epidemic, and there are often very well-meaning pediatricians who look at a child's growth curve and think that the child is growing too fast and says to a parent, you know, slow down, don't give the child as much food, or the opposite, child's not growing fast enough, push more food. So I think it can start there. I think it can be a parent's own issues. There are so many people with disordered eating, if not full-blown eating disorders, that are having children. So, yes, they can put their own issues into their children, and they need to get help for themselves. And then the media, you know, the influence, those young, I see so many young girls in my office who just don't think they're thin enough because of everything they see on television and the magazines. There's many, many ways that which someone can get pulled away from his or her intuitive signals.
And those, let's just first talk about those media images. I mean, they're just not real, are they?
Oh, they're so not real. They're altered in so many different ways. I mean, with all the technology we have today, you can make someone taller or thinner or make the hair longer. I actually have a client who owns a company that does some of that, and she hates it, and she's, you know, her goal is to let everybody know that a lot of what you see is not real. So that's unfortunate. But then you are seeing a lot of people, a lot of young girls in particular, and actually it's happening with boys now in terms of their muscles, but with the girls, looking at them as these tiny little girls who sometimes are naturally that thin, and then others who actually have eating disorders. I've worked with many young actors who have eating disorders trying to be the image that, you know, that they think that they're supposed to be. There's a lot of people in the industry, agents, who are telling their clients, you must lose 10 pounds because they think that they're going to get better roles that way. Mm-hmm. So it's sad, and we're bombarded by that all the time.
So I guess one of the roles as parents is to, what, explain to our kids that these aren't really real images that they're being bombarded with?
I think that's one piece, and to teach children about how important their inner being is instead of their outer being, and that people come in all different sizes and shapes and hair colors and you know, heights, and to look at these things and sometimes be able to laugh at them and say, this isn't real.
And then what are, like, okay, since we're at that, because probably this is what an age group for what, preteens and maybe 8 or 9 year old girls, would you say, and boys, where they're being bombarded with the media images?
Well, it's even younger and younger. There's some little 5 year olds that come home and say, you know, little kids have bellies, and they'll come home and say, Mommy, I'm fat. And also, if they're hearing this at home, to be very careful as a parent not to say anything disparaging about yourself, because children pick it up. They hear it, they see it, they see a parent weighing herself or himself, and they hear about diets in the home. But it's really horrifying how young they can start thinking that they're fat and not just ideal.
Mm-hmm. And weighing, so is it just not a good idea to weigh?
I don't believe there's any reason for anyone to weigh oneself, to know what she or he weighs. I think scales are very, very evil. They're, first of all, they're not even accurate. You know, they're just a reflection of what of bone and muscle. You don't really know, and fat. You don't really know the components of the body. You can take two men who each of them, you know, weighs 200 pounds, and one of them is an athlete and the other one is sedentary. They weigh the same thing on the scale, but one is very fit and healthy, and the other one may be not as healthy. But from a standpoint of looking at those numbers, people start to become obsessed with the numbers and feel bad about themselves if the scale goes up, feel good about themselves if the scale goes down. And really, I don't think, you know, perhaps when one is pregnant, maybe a doctor needs to make sure that the, you know, that the mother is gaining enough weight. But there's very few instances where we really need to know a number.
You know, it's interesting because my husband, who's very fit and athletic and actually, I looked at him yesterday, and I thought, wow, I asked him, I said, have you been lifting weights? Because he's gotten kind of smaller. So, and he goes, no, I haven't been lifting this summer. And I think he's lost weight, but a lot of times if you were to take his weight and height and put him on the BMI, is considered obese, but his body fat is quite low, his body fat percentage.
Yeah, I don't really believe in the BMI from teaching us much of anything. And when you're talking about, muscle, it's so interesting. Some people will start an exercise program after they've been sedentary, and they're so caught up with the scale, so they're weighing themselves every day to see if they're losing weight, and the weight goes up because muscle holds water, a lot of water. So people start getting discouraged, and they give up their exercise because they say, I'm gaining weight. Now, if they didn't have a scale, and they started feeling better, and they started seeing some, muscle strength, they're going to go on with it. So I think the scale can really sabotage one's mental health.
You know, I know with my clients that I do coaching with, some of them really have a hard time with the scale, and they just prefer to look at their clothing sizes, and they just escape going, well, my clothes get bigger, on them, and or they realize that they're getting smaller in their clothes, and they like to use that versus the scale because the scale can really trip them up.
I also do have an issue with sizes and clothing, too. I have this fantasy that someday clothing manufacturers are going to make clothes with different color codes. So you would go into a store, and there'd be the group of yellows and the group of greens and blues, and then in another store, it would be completely different, so you didn't start to figure out that yellows meant sixes and greens meant tens. I'd like to get people away from all numbers.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't it just what we make it all mean? I mean, if we make a certain number mean a good thing or a bad thing, because I think with anything with standards, we can flip it and make it really be a bad thing about us.
For sure. And the numbers really don't mean anything. You want to look at how you're taking care of yourself in your everyday life. That's what means something. Are you eating intuitively? Are you having movement in your life that feels good? What difference does it make what the number is? There's so many people who are not meant to be this image of, this thin ideal, who are healthier than much healthier than some of the very thin people who are really not eating well and not taking care of themselves. So weight is not, such an absolute criterion.
And those thin people that, so many people aspire to be, aren't they just really obsessed with food all day long?
Well, I think for a lot of very thin people, they're in a starved state. And when you're in a starved state, that obsessional quality rises. Mm-hmm. And they are thinking about it all day long. You're absolutely right.
And so with our kids, we're seeing a rise in obesity with children. Mm-hmm. And parents, when I've been promoting this show, the question that parents had is, what do I do with my child if they're eating past their hunger? And there's concern from the parents. What's something that parents can do?
Well, you first want to look at why. I mean, has there been a lot of restriction in the house? Have there been certain foods that have become overvalued? Children that are told that they can't have their dessert until they finish their meal. Is there an emotional stress going on in the house? So, I mean, you have to look at what is causing this overeating to begin with, and if it really is overeating. Are the parents just seeing a child eating more than he was eating last month and he's in a growth spurt? So first you have to evaluate that. If there truly is some serious overeating going on, I think there needs to be some looking at how the household can change in the whole family's relationship with food. Are there family meals? How are the parents eating? Because role modeling is a very important thing in eating. And I think with young children, you can teach them about hunger and fullness and have them understand that our bodies need food, and that the body tells you when you're hungry. And when you're full, if you keep eating, then perhaps there's something else that's going on. Maybe you're bored, or maybe you're worried about a test in school the next day. And let's take a look at what you really need, because if you're eating beyond that true body fullness signal, it means that you don't need food. You need something else. So it's a very important question, and it's got a complicated answer.
Yeah.
Lots of different things to take into consideration.
So let's break it down to one of them. Like, so if the child is needing something else, but they're maybe eating it because they're upset.
Mm-hmm.
So what is something that a parent can do? Because the parent's concern is, oh my gosh, I don't want my child to have, weight issues. Right. So there's usually good intentions from that.
Yes. But I think that it's really important for a parent to let a child know that her feelings or his feelings, you know, are normal, and that the parent has the capacity to sit with the child with the feelings until, you know, the feelings are completely expressed. The worst thing you can say to a child is, oh, get over it, you know, nothing wrong with you. You know, you're lucky, everything's fine for you. I mean, a child starts to feel that her feelings are not appropriate and can end up stuffing them with food. So I think that the most important thing a parent can do is to be very compassionate and help a child sit with those feelings and learn to bear the feelings. Because really the parent's role is to teach a child how to ultimately be able to soothe herself. So if the parent is very, very soothing, the child takes that in and throughout life is more capable of that self-soothing.
I'm just thinking about when my daughter had a pacifier when she was a baby. Because... And she was a very calm baby. and she liked her pacifier. And she was just very calm. And so when you said soothing, I thought about that.
Well, yes, and I think all babies tend to put their fingers in their mouths or their thumbs or the pacifier. It is a way of learning how to self-soothe.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And then so let's just take my daughter, for instance.
Okay.
So she's now 9. Mm-hmm. And she, you know, obviously doesn't have a pacifier anymore.
Right.
What are ways that I could help her to self-soothe? I mean, and she actually has a pretty, I want to say, healthy relationship with food. Mm-hmm. She's very excited to go take the tomatoes off the tomato plant and eat those.
Uh-huh.
You know, she just listens to her body for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
But for her, how would be ways that I could help her self-soothe now that she doesn't have the pacifier?
Well, one of the great ways is if you have a pet in the house. Help her see that playing with her pet is very comforting. Children get very close to their pets. If there aren't any pets around, to be able to, you know, always feel that there will be an adult around that will listen, to be able to express feelings in certain ways. I mean, to tell a child that if you're feeling upset about something, here's some crayons. Draw your feelings. But talking, drawing, playing, doing other things, calling. Some of these young children are on the computer with emails already, writing mm-hmm. to a friend or calling a friend or making sure that there are enough play dates around. I mean, the age, you know, obviously it depends on the age of the child, what's most appropriate. But letting the child know primarily that whatever you're feeling is very important and normal, and it's okay to have those feelings, and how can you figure out what the feeling is and figure out the appropriate thing. Let's say, for example, that a child is feeling lonely. Maybe just the idea that you sit down with her and set up some play dates will make her feel a little better until the play date is, you know, is going to happen. Or if the child's worried about homework, maybe she needs some help from you and an assurance that she's going to be okay. It's identifying what the actual feeling is and then looking for some appropriate mechanism, whether it's soothing or coping, to help the child get through it. Because I think often children aren't given the opportunity to actually express the feelings, and they are actually pushed away from the feelings so that in a lifetime they don't know how to be with their feelings.
Yes, I remember that quite well as a child when I would cry. I had the tiger mother, mm-hmm. and she did the best that she could with her knowing and her cultural, you know, background. Mm-hmm. But I remember her telling me when I was young, probably like 9 or 10, you know, you can cry when at my funeral.
Oh.
And yeah. That was, I was told not to have feelings, just suck it up and get what you need to get done and be really good at it.
And I would say that I work with a lot of people with eating disorders, and that's very common.
Mm-hmm.
People come in and say, no, it's not okay to have my feelings. In fact, the often the basis of an eating disorder is that a person feels that she can't speak up, or if she speaks up, she's not being heard. So the idea of, you know, do you hear me? Do you see me? Does what I say mean anything to you? Which is a phrase I actually heard on Oprah. It's quite wonderful.
This is Corinne Motokaitis, and you're listening to How She Really Does It. I'm talking with Elise Resch. She's an MSRD and the co-author of Intuitive Eating. And we're talking about children and intuitive eating. So what about, Elise, the parents that are listening right now and going, oh my gosh, my child is 11 years old.
Uh-huh.
I've restricted. We've had fights at the table. I'm doomed. I'm a failure. It's over.
Absolutely not. It's not over. There's so many things that can be done to repair the relationship with between the parents around eating and with the child's own relationship with eating. And I often advise parents to sit down with their children and say, I've been reading some things and talking to some people, and I've started to understand that maybe the way that we've been handling eating in this house isn't actually the best way, and I'm willing to say that I think I'm wrong, and I think that we can start a different way of approaching food. I know that you were born with all of this wisdom. When you were a baby, you cried, and I knew your cry for your diaper or your cry for hunger, and I would feed you, and then when you were done, you would stop eating. And I think somewhere along the way that got off track. And I believe that you are very capable of starting to listen to when you're hungry and when you're full and figure out what foods you like and what foods you don't like. And so I'm going to put that that power back into you. There's a wonderful eating therapist named Ellen Satter. She's written a number of books on children and eating. And she believes, and I agree wholeheartedly, that it's the parent's job to get the food, prepare the food, serve the food, and then it's the child's job to decide how much and what he needs and eats. So children are really very much taken by a parent who says, I think I did something wrong, and they're also very skeptical. Are we really going to change this? And you can ask the child, are there foods in the house or are there foods that are not in the house that you'd like to have in the house if there's been a lot of restriction? I worked with a little girl years ago who was actually 8 years old when she came in. She's now a 15 or 16-year-old, very healthy teenager, and she was not, the parents were both on diets, and it was a very restrictive environment at home. And when she would go to her friends' houses at birthday parties, she would eat lots and lots of chocolate to the point that she would get stomach aches and she'd have to leave the party. And one of the parts of her treatment was to have her be able to ask her parents to have the things in the house, mainly chocolate, that she wanted to have. And some really miraculous things happened with this child. Once she stopped feeling the deprivation of not being able to have the things that she liked, when she would go to parties, she didn't need to make herself sick because it was at home as well. So really helping the child figure out that a lot of what's been going on is a result of this taking over control from the child. So there's lots of hope out there. Lots of ways that you can heal this problem.
And isn't that a great learning opportunity for our kids to say, oh, my parents, you know, they did make a mistake, or when they learned better or differently, they've changed their path.
Yes, I think it's amazing. You know how many people probably friends you have who've said that their parents never said they were sorry, never mm-hmm. said that they were wrong. And it's a wonderful learning experience. And, of course, there's also teaching that can happen with children. It's not that you just say, okay, we're going to have all this food in the house and not have the child really understand the different types of food. And so you can teach a child that there are certain foods that are going to help the child grow, or if he cuts himself, you know, heal the wound or make his bones strong. And you can call it whatever you want, nutritious food or growing foods. One of my clients calls it growing foods. And then there's these other foods, which I like to call play food. And I never call it junk food, because I think when people think of it as junk, it makes them feel bad about themselves when they eat it. And when you consider it play food, I think we all need to have a little bit of play in our lives. And so having a little bit of play food is completely appropriate. And I help kids, and parents can do this with their kids, to understand this concept. I use an analogy about going to school and say, what would your life be like if you went to school 7 days a week from 8 in the morning until 10 at night and never had any playtime? And children look at me and they say, oh, that would be horrible, but I'd be so smart. And I say, right, that's why you don't go to school all that time. You do have time after school and weekends and summers. Now let's turn it around. What if you never had to go to school again? And, you know, they get this gleam in their eyes and go, really? And then most of them will say, oh, yeah, but I wouldn't be able to learn. I said, right. So we go to school for a good part of the day, and then you have some time to play, and you do your homework. And same thing with eating. You're going to want to eat a lot of foods that are going to be healthful for you and nutritious and help you grow and all these other things that make you strong. And then you're going to want to have some play food that maybe isn't going to do anything for your body other than be pleasurable for you. And that's totally normal, and that's how normal eaters eat. And that's very helpful because you take away the shame. Shame is one of the things that I see in a lot of children. They're hiding food. Parents are coming in and telling me that they're finding candy wrappers under the bed, and they didn't even buy the candy. They're getting it from, you know, friends, and they feel very shameful about what they're doing. And the more shameful they feel, the more they hide it, and the more they overeat. So this is something that really has to be addressed.
You know, one of the things that I remember as a kid, and I was a competitive swimmer, and my mom did a great job of, you know, preparing food and cutting things up and putting in the cooler and packing. So, you know, one of the things you talked about, what a parent's job.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other side, she was also kind of very controlling about stuff. And I couldn't really have junk food and that kind of thing. And I remember I was 10 and I went to this really big swim meet. I had no idea it was a fast swim meet. I just was going to swim meet, but my mom couldn't go because she had to work that day. And so I went with my swim coach. So I had my cooler of food and I also had money for the first time. And I went to the snack bar, and I just bought everything that I possibly could. The pink popcorn that's, you know, was jammed together in those bricks. Just everything. And I just had a field day at the snack bar. And I swam my races, and I did well, and I qualified for finals. And then later, my tummy just hurt so bad. And
yes, and I teach that. I teach children that you start to learn. Your body has so much information. Listen to your body. If they have free access to all different types of foods, they don't have that urgency. They're not being deprived, as you were being deprived. They don't have the urgency to take in so much of the food that will actually ultimately, if they eat too much of anything, they're going to get stomach aches. So it's very important. I think actually in the very early years, there's no need to give children candy, you know, at 10 months old or a year old. In the very early years, you give the child a wide array of different tastes and textures of foods, and children will grow up really learning to appreciate all different foods. And then when they discover on their own that there is play food out there, you don't restrict. And if they want to have it in the house, you have it in the house. I have a very radical thought, actually. I believe that at meals, if you put everything on the table, including the play food, you neutralize the whole idea of play food. There's so many struggles in the house. No, you have to eat, you know, so many bites of this before you get your dessert. And so the main nutritious food becomes undervalued, and the dessert is overvalued. So put it on the table and make no comments if the child ends up eating only cookies for a week, and then ultimately she's going to eat everything. I have this incredible privilege to work with clients who came to me for their own disordered eating and have worked with me and have really learned how to tune into their own internal intuitive eater, and they've had children and they're raising their children as intuitive eaters, and the things I'm seeing are just really wonderful. There's a little girl who's now 7, and her mother came to me when she was 7 months old, so she had the opportunity to really bring her up in this way that I'm describing. And this child loves everything. She has no, she feels no difference between foods. She doesn't think certain foods are okay and certain foods aren't okay. And there was a really poignant story on her 7th birthday. Her parents took her out to dinner, and she's always been allowed to order what she wants. And she ordered, I think she wanted crab for her birthday. And when she was done with her meal, the server came over and said, "Well, what would you like for dessert?" And she said, "Oh, no, I don't really want anything." And the server said, "But it's your birthday. You have to have a piece of cake." And she said, "No, I'm not hungry anymore, but you can sing me happy birthday if you want." And there's so many stories about this child, and I've included them in this chapter in the third edition, that are just so wonderful, because she has no sense that she's, you know, this is good food or this is bad food, and she's always been allowed to eat what she wants and when she's hungry, and stop when she's full.
So, Elise, is that just hard for parents to wrap their minds around?
Oh, yes. You know, parents want to do the best job they can, and there's so much pressure that they feel from others. What are people going to think if I let my child have, you know, chocolate, or if I let my child have cookies for lunch? They've heard about the obesity epidemic. They think, no, I can't do that. And as I say, often the pediatrician will encourage them to restrict. And the amount of food children get or the types of food. And so they're very, very scared. And I've worked with lots of people to help calm them from this fear. But really, the results are amazing. It changes children's lives and parents' lives, too. I get so many parents who are in such terrible food struggles with their children, and it goes away.
Well, and those are, it's really hard to be in those environments. I mean, being a child of that, and I remember, you know, having to sit at the table until I ate my peas and those kinds of things, and it was just so horrifying. And so having to go through that as a child and then just being around some friends who have struggles with their children, you know, making them eat this before they can have that. And just the tension that arises in that environment.
And two things can happen. You can either get a child, as I said earlier, who is, you know, grabbing food in other places and feels shame about it and is actually overeating and gaining too much weight. Or you have a child that really shuts down and just says, I'm not going to eat, because the child's exerting his autonomy by saying no and actually is underweight. So in either case, the power has to be put back into the child.
This hour of programming is underwritten by Sutter Davis Hospital, located at Highway 113 and West Covell Boulevard. Sutter Davis Hospital, a culture of caring for the Davis community since 1969. SutterDavis.org or 756-6440. An experience with compassion, August 11th at 7 p.m., Davis Community Church, 412 C Street. On June 3rd, 2009, David H. Bro began a lifelong personal endeavor to help increase awareness of compassion by asking people to share their written concept of the word compassion in a notebook. He will discuss the experience being on the corner of 3rd and C Streets in downtown Davis and the characteristics of true compassion. There will be a Q&A period afterwards, and self-published book Compassion Davis, California will be available for purchase and signing. The event is free, all are welcome, and refreshments will be served. This is Karen Motokaitis, and my guest today is Elise Resch. She is the co-author of Intuitive Eating, and her third edition is going to have a chapter about children and intuitive eating, and that's what we're discussing today. Elise, one of the things that you mentioned today in our interview was about shame and judgment. So it sounds like, as parents, one of the things that we can do to really help our kids is alleviate any shame around food and to not have judgment.
That's the most important thing, and I think it starts with the parent looking at his or her own feelings about body and food, because if there's a problem with the parent, it's going to be carried over to the child.
Are you familiar with Brené Brown?
Oh, I am. She's wonderful.
And I interviewed her. She's going to be back in August, but I interviewed her a few months ago, and we talked for the entire hour about the ability to love others mm-hmm. is based on your ability to love yourself. Mm-hmm. And that sounds like the same thing with food. Like your relationship with food, if you've got judgment and shame around food, that's what you're going to pass on to your children. You're going to judge them around food.
I agree 100%. She talks about compassion and courage and connection. Mm-hmm. And that compassion has to start with oneself, self-compassion. So many people come into my office and have told me that they have felt shame from the time they're little children, and now they're, you know, in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and having really terrible relationship with food. And I help them see that the food got them through things as a coping mechanism when they knew no other way to cope, and to let go of the shame and to really be compassionate toward themselves.
And what do you do with people that, parents that really believe that, you know, I need to berate to help them change, either themselves? I mean, because parents do this, right? I have parents all the time go, oh, gosh, I don't know why my child's so hard on themselves. And I look at them and I go, well, you're pretty hard on yourself, aren't you?
Oh, and berating a child never works. Positive reinforcement is much better. I used to teach second grade before I became a dietitian, and I'd go into the classroom and I'd say, oh, look at how nicely Johnny's sitting up, and the whole class would sit up and, you know, be ready to listen versus yelling at them to stop talking. You know, it's berating doesn't work.
And so for people that think that they need to be tough on themselves, right? Mm-hmm. For parents to think, okay, I've got to be tough on myself. Because when I work with my clients, we talk a lot about being compassionate with themselves, and they really struggle. It's like, how can, if I'm compassionate, how will I actually get this done?
Well, we have to get away from black and white thinking. It doesn't mean you either yell at yourself or you let it all go. Being compassionate means you understand the reasons behind the things that you've done, and you start looking at how it's benefited you and what it's taken away from you. I always have people take a look at the pros and cons of their actions, and very often what has happened is it's done a lot for them, the overeating, let's say, but it's also taken a lot away from them. They don't feel well, they're medically perhaps not healthy, and so to be able to find that middle ground of being able to listen to, by the way, not just the tongue, but listen to all of the body in terms, now we're talking about eating, in terms of making choices about eating. How is this going to taste? Is it going to be satisfying? Am I going to get a stomach ache from it? Am I going to get a headache if I wait too long or if I eat foods that, don't agree with me? So it's about being somewhere in the middle and not just saying, let all hell break loose. Mm-hmm. It's being mindful. Mindfulness is one of the most important things in one's eating, and listening. Am I hungry? Am I eating because I'm hungry or because I'm upset? Am I eating foods that are satisfying and delicious? And I think satisfaction is one of the most important driving forces of intuitive eating, finding a way to eat foods that actually please you rather than, if you're mindless, you don't even know that you've eaten, so there's no satisfaction. If you're over full, the food doesn't taste as good. If you're over hungry and you're shoveling it in, it doesn't taste as good. If you're eating emotionally, it doesn't taste as good. So, just finding that middle ground of having a level of mindfulness without judgment. And each experience one has is an opportunity for growth and learning without judgment. I always say, come from a place of curiosity, not judgment.
I love that. Well, and I think sometimes people think, if I'm compassionate, I just need to accept, what is happening. That's compassion and or acquiesce. And compassion is when you say come from a place of curiosity, learning, like, okay, so you have done this, and what can we learn from this, and is that how we want to be and live?
Yes, and I think the word acceptance for some people just means, as you were implying, that it just is this way and nothing's going to change. I like the word respect. Mm-hmm. I think it's very helpful to say I respect myself for being a survivor, for getting through life, for doing the best that I could do when I knew no other way to do it, and what can I learn, and how can I make changes that are going to give me a more satisfying and calm life.
And now I have a question for you about, parents that have their own belief systems, parents that have their own fears about themselves, and then when they're working with their own children, mm-hmm. right, because that's such an extension of us,
yeah.
right? Because I had some listeners email in and say, how do I work with my child when I was berated and it eventually caused disordered eating amongst me?
Well, I think that's a beginning right there for the person to accept that, I'm using acceptance, that a fact that can't be changed, that life was not very helpful in terms of eating for that person, and to learn that that can be changed with the child. But I think that the person has to go through some sort of treatment or reading and changing the way that he or she thinks about herself or himself and heal, because trying to teach a child to trust the body when the parent is walking around, as I say, continuing to berate herself about size or restrict herself and be on diets, it's not going to work, because the children are going to, do what the parents do rather than what they say. And mm-hmm. so I think the first step is really, healing oneself.
And then what about when parents don't necessarily verbalize their fear or their judgments? I have my own beliefs about this, but mm-hmm. I want to know what your thoughts are about the children.
Oh, they're smart, these kids. I have a wonderful Kathy cartoon, and I call it the telling glance. And, the mother isn't saying anything, but the way she's looking, you're giving the 1-2 up and down. Look, children, pick it up. There's absolutely no way for them to miss that.
Mm-hmm. so the kids can feel what's going on.
Oh, sure.
So it just sounds like a lot of this stuff with our children is really us doing the work on ourselves and then leading by example with our kids and teaching.
Yes. One of my clients has went through a very serious eating disorder, and she has two little boys that she has brought up in this way, raising her children as intuitive eaters. And her 5-year-old said to his father, "Daddy, eat your vegetables. You're not eating any vegetables." The mother didn't understand because she's never told him that he should eat vegetables, but the child just knew, and he was seeing his father not eat the vegetables, so he took over the parental role. But usually it's the opposite. The children will do what the parents are doing.
So with this, with putting all the food out, there's not any saying, oh, you need to have some vegetables, you need to have some meat. It's just putting it all out there and letting the kids...
Well, see, I think if you have this education process going on at the same time, so the children understand that they need protein, they need calcium, they need, you know, carbohydrates, they need fats, they need all of these different foods, and that play food is part of that, you don't have to sit there and say, eat your vegetables. Over time, and especially if they've been oriented to a lot of, you know, healthy foods early on, they will have a nice, balanced meal. Maybe one day they won't eat any vegetables, and the next day that's all they want are vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
The little girl I was referring to before, who told the waiter that he could sing for her, she gets up in the morning sometimes and wants tofu and hearts of palm. I think I may have told you this the last time we talked. Or class had to bring in some food, and she wanted to bring bok choy in. I mean, she loves going to the market and looking at all the vegetables, but she also loves ice cream, and mm-hmm. she likes candy, but it's just not... she's not deprived, and so she doesn't have to feel that it's, you know, this golden ring that she's going for.
I remember when my older daughter was like 2 or 3 years old, and one day she sat down and she ate a whole pork chop. That's just what she had.
Uh-huh.
And then she was done. She's like, "No, I'm done." And she got up and, you know, she had her glass of milk probably because she likes to drink milk, and she was done. That was, and then for a few days she didn't have any meat because she. Her body just didn't need it, and it was so fascinating to watch her.
Well, you see, well, how intuitive that was, and
mm-hmm.
and also children go through different growth spurts, and sometimes they eat more, sometimes they eat less, sometimes they like a certain food for weeks on end, and then they don't like it at all. And it's just trusting that child will have the wisdom to get the balance. But again, the parent's job is to orient the child to a lot of different foods, to make sure that there are foods in the house. Preparing some things, having a refrigerator full of fresh fruits that are washed and, you know, vegetables that are washed. The child has access to this, so that the only thing he has is not just, you know, processed food.
Mm-hmm.
So it's work. I mean, it takes a lot of work on the parent's part, and it takes a trust in the child that the child will get the balance.
And so if kids want to bring processed foods into the house,
mm-hmm.
you're fine with that?
Yes, I'm definitely fine with that. I think that it needs to have this other, you know, piece of it. The education part is an important part, but not at the moment saying, no, you can't have that, because that's all he's going to want.
You know, I've noticed that when we bring in certain foods, like new things that mm-hmm. we haven't had, they tend to, the kids like, oh, they get really excited about it. And then what I tend to do is I just buy a lot of it and I just stick it in the pantry.
Mm-hmm.
And after the first couple times, they're kind of over it.
For sure, it happens all the time. It can happen for me.
Mm-hmm.
If I have something new that I'm loving, I want to have it every day, and then I forget that it's there. And for kids, if they don't think that they're being bad by wanting it, or if they're not told, no, you can't have it, you've got to eat this first, there's something called habituation, where you it's not just with food, it's in many things, but if you eat the same food every day, after a while, it loses its excitement. And the only way it maintains its excitement is if it's forbidden.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, no, we got this lentil soup, and we all really liked it. I mean, then this can be for ice cream or whatever, but we've always had plenty of ice cream in our house, so that's not been an issue. But it was this new lentil soup, and so I had to buy enough so it could feed, you know, we have a lot of people in our family mm-hmm. to feed us. And my kids really, really liked it, and it was like, oh, my gosh, this is a new thing. Let's keep having it, you know. And then now we still have a couple of boxes of it because they're kind of over it.
Uh-huh.
But the same thing can happen if I bring in, say, like pita chips or something. And they get really excited because it's something new. But then as long as they know, and I found this, as long as they know that there's, it's not going to be deprivation, mm-hmm. right? Like, oh, I have to get to it because this is, you know, there's not going to be enough. Mm-hmm. And somehow that there was that learning, I guess, in our household. But the food just stops being an issue, you know, when there's plenty of it.
That's one of the reasons that diets don't work, is that people are deprived on diets. And once they go through a period of that deprivation, they can't stand it, and then they overdo on the things that they didn't have. So same thing goes in the household. There needs to be enough of things so children feel they'll get enough of it and know that it's going to continue to be there. And we don't just have it right now. People, before they go on diets, they go through what we call Last Supper eating, because they know they're not going to, well, they're not going to be able to have certain things, so they eat as much of it as they can before they go on the diet. And that's, it's just even the mere, you know, perception of future deprivation leads people to overeat.
And you said trust. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like we parents need to trust that our children can trust themselves.
Yes. Yes. Well said.
And isn't that hard? I mean, just not even just with food, but it's so hard for parents to, like, really have faith that, okay, you know, my child is going to be okay.
Well, it's trust with education.
Okay.
You know, you don't let a child run into the street or put his finger in a, you know, on the stove in the fire, because you're teaching the child that this is dangerous. With eating, you teach the child by role modeling, by offering lots of different kinds of food, by having conversations, as I mentioned earlier, about different types of food. So the child is educated and has likes many different foods if offered early on, and if there's a neutral way in offering them and they're not being pushed to eat them. So over time, yes, you trust that child is going to be able to be fine. And we don't need to have everything, you know, each day, every nutrient each day. It's over time getting enough of the different kinds of foods in. And ultimately, those children are going to leave the house. And I'll tell you, there are a lot of people who've gone off to college and have ended up gaining a lot of weight because they didn't get to have the things they wanted. They were controlled about their eating when they were in the house. And they go off and they're out of control. So at some point, a child is going to become a teenager and leave the house, and you're not going to be there to tell them how many, you know, servings of peas, as you said, or whatever that that they need to have. And so this is building a foundation for the future.
That's a good way to look at it. So like when parents are going, oh my gosh, I can just have this free-for-all in the food, it's about, but it's not just, oh, here you go and just have at it. It's about, okay, how are you going to respect your body? How are you going to help your body grow? And
yes, and that's what a parent does. As I say, a parent teaches a child many things. And so part of this is that kind of information and conversation and acknowledgement that things are going to change, and that the parent is going to trust that the child will make decisions, as you say, that respect the body and help them feel good and be healthy and enjoy food and get satisfaction. So it's not just here's lots of bags of candy, go to it. It has to be changed in terms of the environment in the house.
And then also, how does your body feel after you eat these things?
How does your body feel is so important. And this little girl that I mentioned, who's now in her teens, and she was 8 when she came here, she didn't like getting tummy aches from eating all the chocolate cake and cookies at her friends' houses and having to go home and miss the party. She didn't like it. And she didn't understand why she was eating that much of it there. And so she was very happy to be able to eat some every day and not overdo in any particular time, because she didn't need to anymore, because the food wasn't then in the house. And the parents were very cooperative and eventually got off of dieting themselves. And that was an important piece of it, too.
Wow. And so one of the things you talk about these clients that you've had for a long period of time, right? And in our culture where it's like, you know, lose pound, you know, 30 pounds in 30 days, or, you know, the overnight success stories. I mean, this process that you're talking about, how long does it take for people?
Well, first of all, and I'm so glad you're bringing this up, Karen, is that this is not about weight loss. Intuitive eating is not focused on weight loss. It's focused on changing one's relationship with food. Now, we can't ignore the fact that a lot of people feel they're unhealthy, they feel a need to appropriately lose some weight. So weight loss gets put on the back burner. And if the person is meant to lose weight, then so be it. The weight will come off after someone stops doing the compulsive overeating as a result of deprivation or emotional eating. So it's not about, you know, how long is this process for weight loss. It's how long does it take to change the distorted thoughts and to be able to find coping mechanisms to deal with the emotions. And for some people, it's a very short process because they haven't been so entrenched in dieting and they don't have a serious eating disorder. And for others, it can take years because of the destructiveness of their childhoods in terms of eating. So it's not a, you know, this is 10 easy steps and at the end of that you lose so many pounds. It's nothing like that.
No, and I know with the clients that I work with, I mean, what happens is they have this freedom or they become happy with themselves. You know, and the weight loss is a byproduct, or the way that their body changes is a byproduct. It's like when I coach swimming and people become successful, or even when I became a national champion in swimming, I mean, that was the byproduct. That wasn't what the journey was about.
And this is a process. You're right. It's a process, and the freedom is the goal, and that's something I say all the time. You're going to be so free. You're not going to be sitting there worrying that you've done something wrong or did you count the right amount of carbohydrate grams, or it's just a complete freedom from that. And I've seen a lot of people who really aren't meant to lose a lot of weight, and they don't lose weight because their bodies are where they're supposed to be, but they say they're so happy. The thought about weight loss is gone because they're just happy in their lives now that they're not worrying about it. So there's a lot of healing that comes from this process of taking the focus off of weight loss and putting the focus on, am I eating in response to my hunger? Am I paying attention to the thoughts I have that are distorted? Am I challenging them? Am I finding ways to cope without using food? And am I honoring my fullness? And am I moving? And we all need to move and not associate exercise with weight loss. You and I talked about that before. So It's really a very healing process. It's not linear. Diets tend to be linear, and then you completely fall off of them. This is it's a winding road with lots of opportunities to learn and grow.
Yeah, one of the things that I talk a lot about with my clients is that it's practice. You show up and you continue to practice. Mm-hmm. And that I love that winding road analogy, because it's not just you do A and then you get B and then you get C. It's all encompassing of everything. But we just continue to practice.
Well, you practice the mindfulness so that you are aware. You're paying attention to your body and how it feels. You're paying attention to hunger, fullness. You're paying attention to your thoughts. It's staying present for life, and life becomes much more meaningful and satisfying when you're present and not running away from things.
You're happy. So as we're wrapping up, Elise, what are a couple of takeaways for parents with kids that they can do and start practicing in their own lives?
I think the first thing is to truly examine their own relationship with food and see whether what they're doing is actually harmful to the children. See how they're talking to themselves about their bodies, how they're talking out loud, how they're not participating in life because they're not happy with their bodies, or they're talking about bad and good food. So the first thing is, you know, looking within and making that change. The second thing is then sitting down with the child and saying, let's try something. Let's do something different. Not try. Let's do something different, because this isn't working, and I'm going to take responsibility for how I've taken over and tried to control your eating, and I really believe that you have this ability within you to guide you. If you start listening to your hunger and your fullness, and we change the environment in the house. And also, I think it's really important for families to do things together and go out hiking and take walks together and eat meals together. It's hard. I mean, it's really hard. Kids have lots of different schedules. Both parents may be working. But whenever possible, to sit down and have meals and have those be joyous times, not argue with the children and not tell them what to eat, but sit there and enjoy the food and have the children see you enjoying the food. So, again, this role modeling is so important.
And what about with families? Because I hear parents say, well, you know, my children are just picky eaters, so it's just really hard to have the family dinner. What do you say to that?
Well, again, are they picky eaters because they've been pushed to eat and they're really exerting their need for autonomy by saying, no, I'm not going to eat? So you end up becoming very neutral. You put food on the table. You don't become a short order cook. You don't make three meals. You just put the meal on the table that's cooked for the family, and also some other things that you know the child does like. So maybe there's some nuts on the table, or some cheese, or some whole grain crackers, some fruits, vegetables. And if the child doesn't like chicken, but he can make perhaps a peanut butter sandwich, that's fine. So over time, when that child realizes that nobody is trying to push him, he's going to try other things. And I've seen that happen over and over, children who are so unwilling. You know, unless we've got some more serious problems, some sensory integration problems, things that children need other help with occupational therapists. We're talking about a child who's really just decided, you know, no, I'm not going to eat anything but white pasta and french fries. So you put all that food out there, the family eats it, and you say nothing. And over time, you know, children will kind of check and see if they're being, you know, watched, and they might sneak a little piece of broccoli. And I have seen it happen over and over.
You know, I've noticed that my kids, things that I really like, my kids want to be a part of that.
Yes.
You know, and then the same thing with my husband. There are things I may not like, but he really likes, and they want to be a part of that. It's like, oh, mom or dad really likes this.
Right. So if mom and dad are sitting there and they're eating broccoli and, you know, many other things and say nothing, eventually the child will want to try to be like mom and dad. So that's such a powerful tool right there.
Well, Elise, thank you so much for coming back.
Oh, you're welcome. I've enjoyed it.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
This is Corinne Motokaitis, and you've been listening to How She Really Does It. My guest today is Elise Reich, and she's the co-author of Intuitive Eating, and her third edition will be coming out with a chapter on children and intuitive eating.
Early fog is lifting, she's in a rowboat on a lake. She is dreaming, she is drifting, never been so wide awake.
Captured in the moment by the beauty all around her, there's nowhere else that she would rather be. And Virginia looks up, she says this could be my day. And she
saves her money, grabs her backpack, hops a jet plane, heads to France, grows a garden, writes a screenplay, and she's learning how to dance. And all the possibilities of her imagination are turning into her reality. And Virginia looks up, she says this could be perfectly clear.